but a tool that is useful for finding food and mates, escaping from enemies, and so on. Natural selection explains how this design came to be, using a second idea, the actuarial statistics of reproduction in the organism's ancestors. Take a good look at the two ideas. 1. A part of an organism appears to have been engineered to enhance its reproduction. 2. That organism's ancestors reproduced more effectively than their competitors. Note that 1 and 2 are logically independent. They are about different things, engineering design and birth and death rates. They are about different organisms, the one you're interested in and its ancestors. You can say that an organism has good vision and that good vision should help it reproduce, 1, without knowing how well that organism or any organism in fact reproduces, 2. Since design merely implies an enhanced probability of reproduction, a particular organism with well-designed vision may in fact not reproduce at all. Maybe it will be struck by lightning. Conversely, it may have a myopic sibling that in fact reproduces better, if, for instance, the same lightning bolt killed a predator who had the sibling in its sights. The theory of natural selection says that 2, the ancestor's birth and death rates, is the explanation for 1, the organism's engineering design, so it is not circular in the least. This means that Chomsky was too flip when he dismissed natural selection as having no substance, as nothing more than a belief that there is some naturalistic explanation for a trait. In fact, it is not so easy to show that a trait is a product of selection. The trait has to be hereditary. It has to enhance the probability of reproduction of the organism relative to organisms without the trait, in an environment like the one its ancestors lived in. There has to have been a sufficiently long lineage of similar organisms in the past, and because natural selection has no foresight, each intermediate stage in the evolution of an organ must have conferred some reproductive advantage on its possessor. Darwin noted that his theory made strong predictions and could easily be falsified. All it would take is the discovery of a trait that showed signs of design, but that appeared somewhere other than at the edge of a lineage of replicators that could have used it to help in their replication. One example would be the existence of a trait designed only for the beauty of nature, such as a beautiful but cumbersome peacock tail evolving in moles, whose potential mates are too blind to be attracted to it. Another would be a complex organ that can exist in no useful intermediate form, such as a part wing that could not have been useful for anything until it was 100% of its current size and shape. A third would be an organism that was not produced by an entity that can replicate, such as some insect that spontaneously grew out of rocks like a crystal. A fourth would be a trait designed to benefit an organism other than the one that caused the trait to appear, such as horses evolving saddles. In the comic strip Lil Abner, the cartoonist Al Capp features selfless organisms called schmooze that laid chocolate cakes instead of eggs, and that cheerfully barbecued themselves so that people could enjoy their delicious, boneless meat. The discovery of a real-life schmoo would instantly refute Darwin. Hasty dismissals aside, Chomsky raises a real issue when he brings up alternatives to natural selection. Thoughtful evolutionary theorists since Darwin have been adamant that not every beneficial trait is an adaptation to be explained by natural selection. When a flying fish leaves the water, it is extremely adaptive for it to re-enter the water. But we do not need natural selection to explain this happy event. Gravity will do just fine. Other traits, too, need an explanation different from selection. Sometimes a trait is not an adaptation in itself, but a consequence of something else that is an adaptation. There is no advantage to our bones being white instead of green. But there is an advantage to our bones being rigid. Building them out of calcium is one way to make them rigid, and calcium happens to be white. Sometimes a trait is constrained by its history, like the S-bend in our spine that we inherited when four legs became bad and two legs good. Many traits may just be impossible to grow within the constraints of a body plan and the way the genes build the body. The biologist J.B.S. Haldane once said that there are two reasons why humans do not turn into angels: moral imperfection and a body plan that cannot accommodate both arms and wings. And sometimes a trait comes about by dumb luck. If enough time passes in a small population of organisms, all kinds of coincidences will be preserved in it, a process called genetic drift. For example, in a particular generation, all the stripeless organisms might be hit by lightning or die without issue. Stripedness will reign thereafter, whatever its advantages or disadvantages. Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Lewontin have accused biologists, unfairly most believe, of ignoring these alternative forces and putting too much stock in natural selection. They ridicule such explanations as just-so stories, an allusion to Kipling's whimsical tales of how various animals got their body parts. Gould and Lewontin's essays have been influential in the cognitive sciences, and Chomsky's skepticism that natural selection can explain human language is in the spirit of their critique. But Gould and Lewontin's potshots do not provide a useful model of how to reason about the evolution of a complex trait. One of their goals was to undermine theories of human behavior that they envisioned as having right-wing political implications. The critiques also reflect their day-to-day professional concerns. Gould is a paleontologist, and paleontologists study organisms after they have turned into rocks. They look more at grand patterns in the history of life than at the workings of an individual's long-defunct organs. When they discover, for example, that the dinosaurs were extinguished by an asteroid slamming into the Earth and blacking out the sun, small differences in reproductive advantages understandably seem beside the point. Lewontin is a geneticist, and geneticists tend to look at the raw code of the genes and their statistical variation in a population rather than the complex organs they build. Adaptation can seem like a minor force to them, just as someone's examining the ones and zeros of a computer program in machine language without knowing what the program does might conclude that the patterns are without design. The mainstream in modern evolutionary biology is better represented by biologists like George Williams, John Maynard Smith, and Ernst Mayr, who are concerned with the design of whole living organisms. Their consensus is that natural selection has a very special place in evolution, and that the existence of alternatives does not mean that the explanation of a biological trait is up for grabs, depending only on the taste of the explainer. The biologist Richard Dawkins has explained this reasoning lucidly in his book, The Blind Watchmaker. Dawkins notes that the fundamental problem of biology is to explain complex design. The problem was appreciated well before Darwin. The theologian William Paley wrote, "In crossing a heath, suppose I pitched my foot against a stone and were asked how the stone came to be there. I might possibly answer that, for anything I knew to the contrary, it had lain there forever. Nor would it perhaps be very easy to show the absurdity of this answer. But suppose I had found a watch upon the ground, and it should be inquired how the watch happened to be in that place. I should hardly think of the answer which I had before given, that for anything I knew, the watch might have always been there." Paley noted that a watch has a delicate arrangement of tiny gears and springs that function together to indicate the time. Bits of rock do not spontaneously exude metal, which forms itself into gears and springs, which then hop into an arrangement that keeps time. We are forced to conclude that the watch had an artificer who designed the watch with the goal of timekeeping in mind. But an organ like an eye is even more complexly and purposefully designed than a watch. The eye has a transparent protective cornea, a focusing lens, a light-sensitive retina at the focal plane of the lens, an iris whose diameter changes with the illumination, muscles that move one eye in tandem with the other, and neural circuits that detect edges, color, motion, and depth. It is impossible to make sense of the eye without noting that it appears to have been designed for seeing, if for no other reason than it displays an uncanny resemblance to the man-made camera. If a watch entails a watchmaker and a camera entails a camera maker, then an eye entails an eye maker, namely God. Biologists today do not disagree with Paley's laying out of the problem. They disagree only with his solution. Darwin is history's most important biologist because he showed how such organs of extreme perfection and complication could arise from the purely physical process of natural selection. And here is the key point. Natural selection is not just a scientifically respectable alternative to divine creation. It is the only alternative that can explain the evolution of a complex organ like the eye. The reason that the choice is so stark, God or natural selection, is that structures that can do what the eye does are extremely low-probability arrangements of matter. By an unimaginably large margin, most objects thrown together out of generic stuff, even generic animal stuff, cannot bring an image into focus, modulate incoming light, and detect edges and depth boundaries. The animal stuff in an eye seems to have been assembled with the goal of seeing in mind. But in whose mind, if not God's? How else could the mere goal of seeing well cause something to see well? The very special power of natural selection is to remove the paradox. What causes eyes to see well now is that they descended from a long line of ancestors that saw a bit better than their rivals, which allowed them to out-reproduce those rivals. The small, random improvements in seeing were retained and combined and concentrated over the eons, leading to better and better eyes. The ability of many ancestors to see a bit better in the past causes a single organism to see extremely well now. Another way of putting it is that natural selection is the only process that can steer a lineage of organisms along the path in the astronomically vast space of possible bodies, leading from a body with no eye to a body with a functioning eye. The alternatives to natural selection can, in contrast, only grope randomly. The odds that the coincidences of genetic drift would result in just the right genes coming together to build a functioning eye are infinitesimally small. Gravity alone may make a flying fish fall into the ocean, a nice big target, but gravity alone cannot make bits of flying fish embryo fall into a place to make a flying fish eye. When one organ develops, a bulge of tissue or some nook or cranny can come along for free, the way an S-bend accompanies an upright spine. But you can bet that such a cranny will not just happen to have a functioning lens and a diaphragm and a retina all perfectly arranged for seeing. It would be like the proverbial hurricane that blows through a junkyard and assembles a Boeing 747. For these reasons, Dawkins argues that natural selection is not only the correct explanation for life on Earth, but is bound to be the correct explanation for anything we would be willing to call life anywhere in the universe. And adaptive complexity, by the way, is also the reason that the evolution of complex organs tends to be slow and gradual. It is not that large mutations and rapid change violate some law of evolution. It is only that complex engineering requires precise arrangements of delicate parts. And if the engineering is accomplished by accumulating random changes, those changes had better be small. Complex organs evolve by small steps for the same reason that a watchmaker does not use a sledgehammer and a surgeon does not use a meat cleaver. So, we now know which biological traits to credit to natural selection and which ones to other evolutionary processes. What about language? In my mind, the conclusion is inescapable. Every discussion in this book has underscored the adaptive complexity of the language instinct. It is composed of many parts, syntax with its discrete combinatorial system building phrase structures, morphology, a second combinatorial system building words, a capacious lexicon, a revamped vocal tract, phonological rules and structures, speech perception, parsing algorithms, learning algorithms. Those parts are physically realized as intricately structured neural circuits, laid down by a cascade of precisely timed genetic events. What these circuits make possible is an extraordinary gift, the ability to dispatch an infinite number of precisely structured thoughts from head to head by modulating exhaled breath. The gift is obviously useful for reproduction. Think of William's parable of little Hans and Fritz being ordered to stay away from the fire and not to play with the saber tooth. Randomly jigger a neural network or mangle a vocal tract, and you will not end up with a system with these capabilities. The language instinct, like the eye, is an example of what Darwin called that perfection of structure and co-adaptation which justly excites our admiration. And as such, it bears the unmistakable stamp of nature's designer, natural selection. If Chomsky maintains that grammar shows signs of complex design, but is skeptical that natural selection manufactured it, what alternative does he have in mind? What he repeatedly mentions is physical law. Just as the flying fish is compelled to return to the water, and calcium-filled bones are compelled to be white, human brains might, for all we know, be compelled to contain circuits for universal grammar. He writes, "These skills, for example, learning a grammar, may well have arisen as a concomitant of structural properties of the brain that developed for other reasons. Suppose that there was selection for bigger brains, more cortical surface, hemispheric specialization for analyzing processing, or many other structural properties that can be imagined. The brain that evolved might well have all sorts of special properties that are not individually selected. There would be no miracle in this, but only the normal workings of evolution. We have no idea, at present, how physical laws apply when 10 to the 10th power neurons are placed in an object the size of a basketball under the special conditions that arose during human evolution. We may not, just as we don't know how physical laws apply under the special conditions of hurricanes sweeping through junkyards. But the possibility that there is an undiscovered corollary of the laws of physics that causes brains of human size and shape to develop the circuitry for universal grammar seems unlikely for many reasons. At the microscopic level, what set of physical laws could cause a surface molecule guiding an axon along a thicket of glial cells to cooperate with millions of other such molecules to solder together just the kinds of circuits that would compute something as useful to an intelligent social species as grammatical language? The vast majority of the astronomical ways of wiring together a large neural network would surely lead to something else. Bat sonar, or nest building, or go-go dancing, or, most likely of all, random neural noise. At the level of the whole brain, the remark that there has been selection for bigger brains is, to be sure, common in writings about human evolution, especially from paleoanthropologists. Given that premise, one might naturally think that all kinds of computational abilities might come as a byproduct. But if you think about it for a minute, you should quickly see that the premise has it backwards. Why would evolution ever have selected for sheer bigness of brain, that bulbous, metabolically greedy organ? A large-brained creature is sentenced to a life that combines all the disadvantages of balancing a watermelon on a broomstick, running in place in a down jacket, and for women, passing a large kidney stone every few years. Any selection on brain size itself would surely have favored the pinhead. Selection for more powerful computational abilities, language, perception, reasoning, and so on, must have given us a big brain as a byproduct, not the other way around. But even given a big brain, language does not fall out the way that flying fish fall out of the air. We see language in dwarfs whose heads are much smaller than a basketball. We also see it in hydrocephalics, whose cerebral hemispheres have been squashed into grotesque shapes, sometimes a thin layer lining the skull like the flesh of a coconut, but who are intellectually and linguistically normal. Conversely, there are specific language impairment victims with brains of normal size and shape, and with intact analytical processing. Recall that one of Gopnik's subjects was fine with math and computers. All the evidence suggests that it is the precise wiring of the brain's microcircuitry that makes language happen, not gross size, shape, or neuron packing. The pitiless laws of physics are unlikely to have done us the favor of hooking up that circuitry so that we could communicate with one another in words. Incidentally, to attribute the basic design of the language instinct to natural selection is not to indulge in just-so storytelling that can spuriously explain any trait. The neuroscientist William Calvin, in his book The Throwing Madonna, explains the left brain specialization for hand control, and consequently for language, as follows. Female hominids held their baby on their left side so the baby would be calmed by their heartbeat. This forced the mothers to use their right arm for throwing stones at small prey. Therefore, the race became right-handed and left-brained. Now, this really is a just-so story. In all human societies that hunt, it is the men who do the hunting, not the women. Moreover, as a former boy, I can attest that hitting an animal with a rock is not so easy. Calvin's throwing Madonna is about as likely as Roger Clemens hurling split-fingered fastballs over the plate with a squirming infant on his lap. In the second edition to his book, Calvin had to explain to readers that he only meant it as a joke. He was trying to show that such stories are no less plausible than serious adaptationist explanations. But such blunt-edged satire misses the point almost as much as if it had been intended as serious. The Throwing Madonna is qualitatively different from genuine adaptationist explanations, for not only is it instantly falsified by empirical and engineering considerations, but it is a non-starter for a key theoretical reason. Natural selection is an explanation for the extremely improbable. If brains are lateralized at all, lateralization on the left is not extremely improbable. Its chances are exactly 50%. We do not need a circuitous tracing of left brains to anything else, for here the alternatives to selection are perfectly satisfying. It is a good illustration of how the logic of natural selection allows us to distinguish legitimate selectionist accounts from just-so stories. To be fair, there are genuine problems in reconstructing how the language faculty might have evolved by natural selection, though the psychologist Paul Bloom and I have argued that the problems are all resolvable. As P.B. Medawar noted, language could not have begun in the form it supposedly took in the first recorded utterance of the infant Lord Macaulay, who, after having been scalded with hot tea, allegedly said to his hostess, "Thank you, madam, the agony is sensibly abated." If language evolved gradually, there must have been a sequence of intermediate forms, each useful to its possessor, and this raises several questions. First, if language involves, for its true expression, another individual, who did the first grammar mutant talk to? One answer might be the 50% of the brothers and sisters and sons and daughters who share the new gene by common inheritance. But a more general answer is that the neighbors could have partly understood what the mutant was saying, even if they lacked the newfangled circuitry. Just using overall intelligence. Though we cannot parse strings like skid crash hospital, we can figure out what they probably mean. And English speakers can often do a reasonably good job understanding Italian newspaper stories based on similar words and background knowledge. If a grammar mutant is making important distinctions that can be decoded by others only with uncertainty and great mental effort, it could set up a pressure for them to evolve the matching system that allows those distinctions to be recovered reliably by an automatic, unconscious parsing process. As I mentioned in Chapter 8, natural selection can take skills that are acquired with effort and uncertainty and hardwire them into the brain. Selection could have ratcheted up language abilities by favoring the speakers in each generation that the hearers could best decode, and the hearers who could best decode the speakers. A second problem is what an intermediate grammar would have looked like. Bates asks, what protoform can we possibly envision that could have given birth to constraints on the extraction of noun phrases from an embedded clause? What could it conceivably mean for an organism to possess half a symbol, or three-quarters of a rule? Monadic symbols, absolute rules, and modular systems must be acquired as a whole, on a yes-or-no basis, a process that cries out for a creationist explanation. The question is rather odd, because it assumes that Darwin literally meant that organs must evolve in successively larger fractions, half, 3/4, and so on. Bates' rhetorical question is like asking what it could possibly mean for an organism to possess half a head or 3/4 of an elbow. Darwin's real claim, of course, is that organs evolve in successively more complex forms. Grammars of intermediate complexity are easy to imagine. They could have symbols with a narrower range, rules that are less reliably applied, modules with fewer rules, and so on. In a recent book, Derek Bickerton answers Bates even more concretely. He gives the term proto-language to chimp signing, pigeons, child language in the two-word stage, and the unsuccessful partial language acquired after the critical period by Genie and other wolf children. Bickerton suggests that Homo erectus spoke in proto-language. Obviously, there is still a huge gulf between these relatively crude systems and the modern adult language instinct, and here Bickerton makes the jaw-dropping additional suggestion that a single mutation in a single woman, African Eve, simultaneously wired in syntax, resized and reshaped the skull, and reworked the vocal tract. But we can extend the first half of Bickerton's argument without accepting the second half, which is reminiscent of hurricanes assembling jetliners. The languages of children, pigeon speakers, immigrants, tourists, aphasics, telegrams, and headlines show that there is a vast continuum of viable language systems varying in efficiency and expressive power, exactly what the theory of natural selection requires. A third problem is that each step in the evolution of a language instinct, up to and including the most recent ones, must enhance fitness. David Premack writes, "I challenge the reader to reconstruct the scenario that would confer selective fitness on recursiveness. Language evolved, it is conjectured, at a time when humans or proto-humans were hunting mastodons. Would it be a great advantage for one of our ancestors squatting alongside the embers to be able to remark, 'Beware of the short beast whose front hoof Bob cracked when, having forgotten his own spear back at camp, he got in a glancing blow with the dull spear he borrowed from Jack?'" Human language is an embarrassment for evolutionary theory because it is vastly more powerful than one can account for in terms of selective fitness. A semantic language with simple mapping rules, of a kind one might suppose that the chimpanzee would have, appears to confer all the advantages one normally associates with discussions of mastodon hunting or the like. For discussions of that kind, syntactic classes, structure-dependent rules, recursion, and the rest are overly powerful devices. Absurdly so. I am reminded of a Yiddish expression, "What's the matter? Is the bride too beautiful?" The objection is a bit like saying that the cheetah is much faster than it has to be, or that the eagle does not need such good vision, or that the elephant's trunk is an overly powerful device, absurdly so. But it is worth taking up the challenge. First, bear in mind that selection does not need great advantages. Given the vastness of time, tiny advantages will do. Imagine a mouse that was subjected to a minuscule selection pressure for increased size, say a 1% reproductive advantage for offspring that were 1% bigger. Some arithmetic shows that the mouse's descendants would evolve to the size of an elephant in a few thousand generations, an evolutionary eye blink. Second, if contemporary hunter-gatherers are any guide, our ancestors were not grunting cavemen with little more to talk about than which mastodon to avoid. Hunter-gatherers are accomplished toolmakers and superb amateur biologists with detailed knowledge of the life cycles, ecology, and behavior of the plants and animals they depend on. Language would surely have been useful in anything resembling such a lifestyle. It is possible to imagine a super-intelligent species whose isolated members cleverly negotiated their environment without communicating with one another. But what a waste! There is a fantastic payoff in trading hard-won knowledge with kin and friends, and language is obviously a major means of doing so. And grammatical devices designed for communicating precise information about time, space, objects, and who did what to whom are not like the proverbial thermonuclear flyswatter. Recursion in particular is extremely useful. It is not, as Premack implies, confined to phrases with tortuous syntax, Without recursion, you can't say, the man's hat, or I think he left. Recall that all you need for recursion is an ability to embed a noun phrase inside another noun phrase, or a clause within a clause, which falls out of rules as simple as, noun phrase consists of determiner, noun, prepositional phrase, and prepositional phrase consists of preposition, noun phrase. With this ability, a speaker can pick out an object to an arbitrarily fine level of precision. These abilities can make a big difference. It makes a difference whether a far-off region is reached by taking the trail that is in front of the large tree, or the trail that the large tree is in front of. It makes a difference whether that region has animals that you can eat, or animals that can eat you. It makes a difference whether it has fruit that is ripe, or fruit that was ripe, or fruit that will be ripe. It makes a difference whether you can get there if you walk for 3 days, or whether you can get there and walk for 3 days. Third, people everywhere depend on cooperative efforts for survival, forming alliances by exchanging information and commitments. This, too, puts complex grammar to good use. It makes a difference whether you understand me as saying that if you give me some of your fruit, I will share meat that I will get, or that you should give me some fruit because I shared meat that I got, or that if you don't give me some fruit, I will take back the meat that I got. And once again, recursion is far from being an absurdly powerful device. Recursion allows sentences like, he knows that she thinks that he is flirting with Mary, and other means of conveying gossip, an apparently universal human vice. But could these exchanges really produce the Rococo complexity of human grammar? Perhaps. Evolution often produces spectacular abilities when adversaries get locked into an arms race, like the struggle between cheetahs and gazelles. Some anthropologists believe that human brain evolution was propelled more by a cognitive arms race among social competitors than by mastery of technology and the physical environment. After all, it doesn't take that much brain power to master the ins and outs of a rock or to get the better of a berry. But outwitting and second-guessing an organism of approximately equal mental abilities with non-overlapping interests at best and malevolent intentions at worst makes formidable and ever-escalating demands on cognition. And a cognitive arms race clearly could propel a linguistic one. In all cultures, social interactions are mediated by persuasion and argument. How a choice is framed plays a large role in determining which alternative people choose. Thus, there could easily have been selection for any edge in the ability to frame an offer so that it appears to present maximal benefit and minimal cost to the negotiating partner, and in the ability to see through such attempts and to formulate attractive counterproposals. Finally, anthropologists have noted that tribal chiefs are often both gifted orators and highly polygynous, a splendid prod to any imagination that cannot conceive of how linguistic skills could make a Darwinian difference. I suspect that evolving humans lived in a world in which language was woven into the intrigues of politics, economics, technology, family, sex, and friendship that played key roles in individual reproductive success. They could no more live with a me Tarzan, you Jane level of grammar than we could. The brouhaha raised by the uniqueness of language has many ironies. The spectacle of humans trying to ennoble animals by forcing them to mimic human forms of communication is one. The pains that have been taken to portray language as innate, complex, and useful, but not a product of the one force in nature that can make innate, complex, useful things is another. Why should language be considered such a big deal? It has allowed humans to spread out over the planet and wreak large changes, but is that any more extraordinary than coral that builds islands, earthworms that shape the landscape by building soil, or the photosynthesizing bacteria that first released corrosive oxygen into the atmosphere, an ecological catastrophe of its time? Why should talking humans be considered any weirder than elephants, penguins, beavers, camels, rattlesnakes, hummingbirds, electric eels, leaf-mimicking insects, giant sequoias, Venus flytraps, echolocating bats or deep-sea fish with lanterns growing out of their heads? Some of these creatures have traits unique to their species, others do not, depending only on the accidents of which of their relatives have become extinct. Darwin emphasized the genealogical connectedness of all living things, but evolution is descent with modification, and natural selection has shaped the raw materials of bodies and brains to fit them into countless differentiated niches. For Darwin, such is the grandeur in this view of life, that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms most beautiful and wonderful have been and are being evolved. Chapter 12. The Language Mavens. Imagine that you are watching a nature documentary. The video shows the usual gorgeous footage of animals in their natural habitats, but the voiceover reports some troubling facts. Dolphins do not execute their swimming strokes properly. White-crowned sparrows carelessly debase their calls. Chickadees' nests are incorrectly constructed. Pandas hold bamboo in the wrong paw. The song of the humpback whale contains several well-known errors, and monkeys' cries have been in a state of chaos and degeneration for hundreds of years. Your reaction would probably be, what on earth could it mean for the song of the humpback whale to contain an error? Isn't the song of the humpback whale whatever the humpback whale decides to sing? Who is this announcer anyway? But for human language, most people think that the same pronouncements not only are meaningful, but are cause for alarm. Johnny can't construct a grammatical sentence. As educational standards decline and pop culture disseminates, the inarticulate ravings and unintelligible patois of surfers, jocks, and valley girls, we are turning into a nation of functional illiterates, misusing hopefully, confusing lie and lay, treating data as a singular noun, letting our participles dangle. English itself will steadily decay unless we get back to basics and start to respect our language again. To a linguist or psycholinguist, of course, language is like the song of the humpback whale. The way to determine whether a construction is grammatical is to find people who speak the language and ask them. So when people are accused of speaking ungrammatically in their own language, or of consistently violating a rule, there must be some different sense of grammatical and rule in the air. In fact, the pervasive belief that people do not know their own language is a nuisance in doing linguistic research. A linguist's question to an informant about some form in his or her speech, say whether the person uses sneaked or snuck, is often lobbed back with the ingenuous counter-question, gee, I better not take a chance. Which is correct? In this chapter, I'd better resolve this contradiction for you. Recall columnist Irma Bombeck, incredulous at the very idea of a grammar gene, because her husband taught 37 high school students who thought that bummer was a sentence. You too might be wondering, if language is as instinctive as spinning a web, if every three-year-old is a grammatical genius, if the design of syntax is coded in our DNA and wired into our brains, why is the English language in such a mess? Why does the average American sound like a gibbering fool every time he opens his mouth or puts pen to paper? The contradiction begins in the fact that the words rule, grammatical, and ungrammatical have very different meanings to a scientist and to a layperson. The rules people learn, or more likely fail to learn, in school are called prescriptive rules, prescribing how one ought to talk. Scientists studying language propose descriptive rules, describing how people do talk. They are completely different things, and there is a good reason that scientists focus on descriptive rules. To a scientist, the fundamental fact of human language is its sheer improbability. Most objects in the universe, lakes, rocks, trees, worms, cows, cars, cannot talk. Even in humans, the utterances in a language are an infinitesimal fraction of the noises people's mouths are capable of making. I can arrange a combination of words that explains how octopuses make love, or how to remove cherry stains. Rearrange the words in even the most minor way, and the result is a sentence with a different meaning, or, most likely of all, word salad. How are we to account for this miracle? What would it take to build a device that could duplicate human language? Obviously, you need to build in some kind of rules, but what kind? Prescriptive rules? Imagine trying to build a talking machine by designing it to obey rules like don't split infinitives, or never begin a sentence with because. It would just sit there. In fact, we already have machines that don't split infinitives. They're called screwdrivers, bathtubs, cappuccino makers, and so on. Prescriptive rules are useless without the much more fundamental rules that create the sentences and define the infinitives and list the word because, to begin with, the rules of chapters 4 and 5. These rules are never mentioned in style manuals or school grammars because the authors correctly assume that anyone capable of reading the manuals must already have the rules. No one, not even a valley girl, has to be told not to say, apples eat the boy, or the child seems sleeping, or who did you meet John and, or the vast, vast majority of the millions of trillions of mathematically possible combinations of words. So when a scientist considers all the high-tech mental machinery needed to arrange words into ordinary sentences, prescriptive rules are, at best, inconsequential little decorations. The very fact that they have to be drilled shows that they are alien to the natural workings of the language system. One can choose to obsess over prescriptive rules, but they have no more to do with human language than the criteria for judging cats at a cat show have to do with mammalian biology. So, there is no contradiction in saying that every normal person can speak grammatically, in the sense of systematically, and ungrammatically, in the sense of non-prescriptively. Just as there is no contradiction in saying that a taxi obeys the laws of physics, but breaks the laws of Massachusetts. But this raises a question. Someone, somewhere, must be making decisions about correct English for the rest of us. Who? There is no English Language Academy, and this is just as well. The purpose of the Académie Française is to amuse journalists from other countries with bitterly argued decisions that the French gaily ignore. Nor were there any founding fathers at some English language constitutional conference at the beginning of time. The legislators of correct English, in fact, are an informal network of copy editors, dictionary usage panelists, style manual and handbook writers, English teachers, essayists, columnists, and pundits. Their authority, they claim, comes from their dedication to implementing standards that have served the language well in the past, especially in the prose of its finest writers, and that maximize its clarity, logic, consistency, conciseness, elegance, continuity, precision, stability, integrity, and expressive range. Some of them go further and say that they are actually safeguarding the ability to think clearly and logically. This radical Whorfianism is common among language pundits, not surprisingly. Who would settle for being a schoolmarm when one can be an upholder of rationality itself? William Sapphire, who writes the weekly column On Language for the New York Times Magazine, calls himself a language maven, from the Yiddish word meaning expert, and this gives us a convenient label for the entire group. To whom I say, maven shmaven, kibitzers and nudniks is more like it, for here are the remarkable facts. Most of the prescriptive rules of the language mavens make no sense on any level. They are bits of folklore that originated for screwball reasons several hundred years ago and have perpetuated themselves ever since. For as long as they have existed, speakers have flouted them, spawning identical plaints about the immediate decline of the language century after century. All the best writers in English at all periods, including Shakespeare and most of the mavens themselves, have been among the flagrant flouters. The rules conform neither to logic nor to tradition, and if they were ever followed, they would force writers into fuzzy, clumsy, wordy, ambiguous, incomprehensible prose in which certain thoughts are not expressible at all. Indeed, most of the ignorant errors these rules are supposed to correct display an elegant logic and an acute sensitivity to the grammatical texture of the language to which the mavens are oblivious. The scandal of the language mavens began in the 18th century. London had become the political and financial center of England, and England had become the center of a powerful empire. The London dialect was suddenly an important world language. Scholars began to criticize it as they would any artistic or civil institution, in part to question the customs, hence authority, of court and aristocracy. Latin was still considered the language of enlightenment and learning, not to mention the language of a comparably vast empire, and it was offered as an ideal of precision and logic to which English should aspire. The period also saw unprecedented social mobility, and anyone who desired education and self-improvement and who wanted to distinguish himself as cultivated had to master the best version of English. These trends created a demand for handbooks and style manuals, which were soon shaped by market forces. Casting English grammar into the mold of Latin grammar made the books useful as a way of helping young students learn Latin. And as the competition became cutthroat, the manuals tried to outdo one another by including greater numbers of increasingly fastidious rules that no refined person could afford to ignore. Most of the hobgoblins of a contemporary prescriptive grammar, don't split infinitives, don't end a sentence with a preposition, can be traced back to these 18th century fads. Of course, forcing modern speakers of English to not to split an infinitive because it isn't done in Latin makes about as much sense as forcing modern residents of England to wear laurels and togas. Julius Caesar could not have split an infinitive if he had wanted to. In Latin, the infinitive is a single word like facere or dicere, a syntactic atom. English is a different kind of language. It is an isolating language, building sentences around many simple words instead of a few complicated ones. The infinitive is composed of two words, a complementizer, to, and a verb, like go. Words, by definition, are arrangeable units, and there is no conceivable reason why an adverb should not come between them. Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its 5-year mission? To explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before. To go boldly where no man has gone before? Beam me up, Scotty. There's no intelligent life down here. As for outlawing sentences that end with a preposition, impossible in Latin for good reasons having to do with its case-marking system, reasons that are irrelevant in case-poor English, as Winston Churchill would have said, it is a rule up with which we should not put. But once introduced, a prescriptive rule is very hard to eradicate, no matter how ridiculous. Inside the educational and writing establishments, the rules survive by the same dynamic that perpetuates ritual genital mutilations and college fraternity hazing. I had to go through it and am none the worse. So why should you have it any easier? Anyone daring to overturn a rule by example must always worry that readers will think he or she is ignorant of the rule, rather than challenging it. I confess that this has deterred me from splitting some split-worthy infinitives. Perhaps most importantly, since prescriptive rules are so psychologically unnatural that only those with access to the right schooling can abide by them, they serve as shibboleths, differentiating the elite from the rabble. The concept of shibboleth, Hebrew for torrent, comes from the Bible. And the Gileadites took the passages of Jordan before the Ephraimites, and it was so, that when those Ephraimites which were escaped said, Let me go over, that the men of Gilead said unto him, Art thou an Ephraimite? If he said, Nay, then said they unto him, Say now Shibboleth. And he said, Sibboleth. For he could not frame to pronounce it right. Then they took him and slew him at the passages of the Jordan, and there fell at that time of the Ephraimites 42,000. Judges chapter 12, verses 5 and 6. This is the kind of terror that has driven the prescriptive grammar market in the United States during the past century. Throughout the country, people have spoken a dialect of English, some of whose features date to the early modern English period, that H.L. Mencken called the American language. It had the misfortune of not becoming the standard of government and education, and large parts of the grammar curriculum in American schools have been dedicated to stigmatizing it as ungrammatical, sloppy speech. Familiar examples are ax a question, workin', ain't, I don't see no birds, he don't, them boys, we was, and past tense forms like drug, seen, clum, drowned, and growed. For ambitious adults who had been unable to complete school, there were full-page magazine ads for correspondence courses containing lists of examples under screaming headlines like, "Do you make any of these embarrassing mistakes?" Frequently, the language mavens claim that non-standard American English is not just different, but less sophisticated and logical. The case, they would have to admit, is hard to make for non-standard irregular verbs like drag, drug, and even more so for regularizations like field and growed. After all, in correct English, Richard Lederer notes, "Today we speak, but first we spoke, some faucets leak, but never loak. Today we write, but first we wrote. We bought our tongues, but never boat." At first glance, the mavens would seem to have a better argument when it comes to the leveling of inflectional distinctions in "he don't" and "we was." But then, this has been the trend in standard English for centuries. No one gets upset that we no longer distinguish the second-person singular form of verbs like "sayest." And by this criterion, it is the non-standard dialects that are superior, because they provide their speakers with second-person plural pronouns like y'all and yous, and standard English does not. At this point, defenders of the standard are likely to pull out the notorious double negative, as in, "I can't get no satisfaction." Logically speaking, the two negatives cancel each other out, they teach. Mr. Jagger is actually saying that he is satisfied. The song should be entitled, "I Can't Get Any Satisfaction." But this reasoning is not satisfactory. Hundreds of languages require their speakers to use a negative element somewhere within the scope, as linguists call it, of a negated verb. The so-called double negative, far from being a corruption, was the norm in Chaucer's Middle English, and negation in Standard French, as in je ne sais pas, where ne and pas are both negative, is a familiar contemporary example. Come to think of it, Standard English is really no different. What do any, even, and at all mean in the following sentences? I didn't buy any lottery tickets. I didn't eat even a single French fry. I didn't eat fried food at all today. Clearly not much. You can't use them alone, as the following strange sentences show. I bought any lottery tickets. I ate even a single French fry. I ate fried food at all today. What these words are doing is exactly what no is doing in non-standard American English, such as the equivalent, "I didn't buy no lottery tickets," agreeing with the negated verb. The slim difference is that non-standard English co-opted the word no as the agreement element, whereas standard English co-opted the word any. Aside from that, they are pretty much translations. And one more point has to be made. In the grammar of standard English, a double negative does not assert the corresponding affirmative. No one would dream of saying, "I can't get no satisfaction," out of the blue to boast that he easily attains contentment. There are circumstances in which one might use the construction to deny a preceding negation in the discourse, but denying a negation is not the same as asserting an affirmative. And even then, one could probably only use it by putting heavy stress on the negative element, as in the following contrived example. As hard as I try not to be smug about the misfortunes of my adversaries, I must admit that I can't get no satisfaction out of his tenured denial. So the implication that use of the non-standard form would lead to confusion is pure pedantry. A tin ear for prosody, stress and intonation, and an obliviousness to the principles of discourse and rhetoric are important tools of the trade for the language maven. Consider an alleged atrocity committed by today's youth. The expression, "I could care less." The teenagers are trying to express disdain, the adults note, in which case they should be saying, "I couldn't care less." If they could care less than they do, that means that they really do care, the opposite of what they are trying to say. But if these dudes would stop ragging on teenagers and scope out the construction, they would see that their argument is bogus. Listen to how the two versions are pronounced. "I couldn't care less." "I could care less." The melodies and stresses are completely different, and for a good reason. The second version is not illogical, it's sarcastic. The point of sarcasm is that by making an assertion that is manifestly false or accompanied by ostentatiously mannered intonation, one deliberately implies its opposite. A good paraphrase is, "Oh yeah, as if there was something in the world that I care less about." Sometimes an alleged grammatical error is logical not only in the sense of rational, but in the sense of respecting distinctions made by the formal logician. Consider this alleged barbarism brought up by nearly every language maven. Everyone returned to their seats. Anyone who thinks a Yonex racket has improved their game, raise your hand. If anyone calls, tell them I can't come to the phone. Someone dropped by, but they didn't say what they wanted. No one should have to sell their home to pay for medical care. He's one of those guys who's always patting themselves on the back. An actual quote from Holden Caulfield and J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye. They explain, "Everyone means everyone," a singular subject which may not serve as the antecedent of a plural pronoun like "them," later in the sentence. "Everyone returned to his seat," they insist. "If anyone calls, tell him I can't come to the phone." If you were the target of these lessons at this point, you might be getting a bit uncomfortable. "Everyone returned to his seat" makes it sound like Bruce Springsteen was discovered during an intermission to be in the audience, and everyone rushed back and converged on his seat to await an autograph. If there is a good chance that a caller may be female, it is odd to ask one's roommate to tell him anything, even if you are not among the people who are concerned about sexist language. Such feelings of disquiet, a red flag to any serious linguist, are well-founded in this case. The next time you get corrected for this sin, ask Mr. Smarty Pants how you should fix the following. "Mary saw everyone before John noticed them." Now watch him squirm as he mulls over the downright unintelligible improvement. "Mary saw everyone before John noticed him." The logical point that you, Holden Caulfield, and everyone but the language mavens intuitively grasp is that everyone and they are not an antecedent and a pronoun referring to the same person in the world, which would force them to agree in number. They are a quantifier and a bound variable, a different logical relationship. "Everyone returned to their seats" means, for all X, X returned to X's seat. The X does not refer to any particular person or group of people. It is simply a placeholder that keeps track of the roles the players play across different relationships. In this case, the X that comes back to a seat is the same X that owns the seat that X comes back to. The there does not in fact have plural number because it refers neither to one thing nor to many things. It does not refer at all. The same goes for the hypothetical caller. There may be one, there may be none, or the phone might ring off the hook with would-be suitors. All that matters is that every time there is a caller, if there is a caller, that caller and not someone else should be put off. On logical grounds, then, variables are not the same thing as the more familiar referential pronouns that trigger number agreement. He meaning some particular guy, they meaning some particular bunch of guys. Some languages are considerate and offer their speakers different words for referential pronouns and for variables, but English is stingy. A referential pronoun must be drafted into service to lend its name when a speaker needs to use a variable. Since these are not real referential pronouns, but only homonyms of them, there is no reason that the vernacular decision to borrow they, their, them for the task is any worse than the prescriptivist's recommendation of he, him, his.